This is Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. We're again interviewing Dr. Julius Youngner at his home on Marlboro Avenue. The date is January 20, 1993. Dr. Youngner, last time we stopped, you had just given yourself a haircut and you were ready to enter primary school in the Bronx. Can you tell us the name of the school and the location, if you remember?
It was PS 11 on Boscobel Avenue. That comes to my mind.
Check. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the neighborhood? It was a neighborhood school, I assume.
Yes.
Okay.
It was a school you walked to.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the Bronx in those days. Your neighborhood.
It was a mixed neighborhood of half Jewish people. It was not the first place I remember living, but I can't remember where the other place was, but this was the second place I remember moving to. And these were newly built apartment houses on a street called Shakespeare Avenue, interestingly enough. It was just apartment house, recently built apartment houses, and still some private dwellings there. And I remember when we moved in across the street, there was a farm that had just stopped working. Later on, they built an apartment house on that farm. And sometime or other, we moved from that house, from the apartment house where we lived on the first floor, across the street to the new apartment house where we lived on the fourth floor. And that was very important for my grandmother, who was very superstitious, because you always moved up, you never moved down. So it was a propitious thing that we could move into a fourth floor apartment.
Was there an elevator?
There was no elevator.
Okay.
No. And what I remember is that the apartment was, I think the farm had been owned, and then the apartment house, which was maybe four stories tall, had been built by a Scotsman who owned it. And it was called the Bonnie Brae, which means the lovely hill, because Shakespeare Avenue was a hill, up a hill. And what I remember about this man, Basti, was he used to come and collect the rent. He was an elderly Scotsman with a thick Scots accent. And the one thing I can remember about him was that in the depths of the Depression, that my mother had very, very difficulty meeting the rent sometime. This man came to collect the rent, and she told him, I didn't overhear the conversation, but she told him that she couldn't pay the rent and what her situation was, and that she was expecting to be able to recover fairly soon because she had lost a great deal of money in the crash, which she had invested in, interesting enough, saving and loans, which just all went under, and there was no insurance in those days at all. And interestingly, the Scotsman said to her, in his thick burr probably, I remember how he spoke, thick Scottish burr, that he was not going to do anything to dispossess us take any action, and that when she could pay, she would repay him what she owed him. And ever since that time, I never have believed in the myth of the stinginess of the Scots. This was a very generous Scotsman, and he's very nice. And my family had a great deal of affection for him.
Okay. Were there any, we're still in primary school, any memorable teachers, anything special that stands out?
It's very interesting when you speak about teachers, because my children have asked me about that. And I have to tell you that my grade school education was a complete blur as far as teachers are concerned. And I can't remember any of my teachers in grade school, their names. In contrast to my children, who can tell you, each one of them can tell you from kindergarten up through high school, the names of all their teachers grade by grade. And I can't do that. I don't remember a name of one teacher.
How about in secondary
school? Never did.
Yeah.
Secondary school, too. I never remembered a teacher's name. I only remember once we had a teacher in high school whose name I remember because her name was Miss Sugar. And you can imagine what the Jewish children did with that name. So that's the only name I do remember.
I see.
But part of the difficulty, my children asked me, how come there's such a blind spot for the teachers and for schooling? And that's because I skipped so many grades. And I think that accounts for it, that I never was anywhere long enough to really get involved with I think that's the only reason I can think of. But it's very interesting. It's just a complete blur to me, my grade school education.
You mentioned last time that you did sports after school.
Yeah.
Any particular special sport?
I played seasonally. I played everything. We had teams that played, which were organized by the street, interestingly enough, and we would play teams on other streets. And it was when I was a little older that the YMHA, there was a YMHA nearby, and they had a basketball league, and the boys from my street joined this league and used to play at the YMHA in this basketball league.
Were there blacks in the neighborhood at the time?
Zero. No blacks. Today the neighborhood is all black and Puerto Rican.
That's why I asked you.
Yeah, it's completely black and Puerto Rican. This was in the West Bronx, not far from University Avenue. And, it's all black now. I do remember early experiences in first grade after my hair was cut. One of the things that I remember is that I was, when I knew the answer to something that the teacher asked, I didn't wait to be called upon, but I just spoke up. I didn't know the rule. I never had gone to kindergarten. I went right into first grade. And my grandmother, so my mother was working, so my grandmother had to come to school. I took a note home. My grandmother went to school, and she was supposed to remind me that I had to wait to be called on, that I didn't know. Also, I can remember in first grade, a confrontation with the teacher because I insisted on pronouncing the word Island. And she had great difficulty convincing me that the S was silent, and I insisted that if the S was there, why did they take it out if they wanted to just be Island? And my grandmother had to come to school again to settle that one. So I obviously overstepped the bounds of first grade student. Those are the only disciplinary problems I remember. There was a problem walking to and from school, especially if you were by yourself, because there was a great territoriality in the area, in the neighborhood. And so if you walk with a group, you were pretty much safe on the way to school. It wasn't so bad on the way to school. It was on the way home after school. And it wasn't bad during lunchtime because I was close enough, so I walked home for lunch very often and walked back. But it was going home after school. It was terror to go by yourself because you had to go through hostile enemy territory, which was the kids on the blocks that you went through. It was like running a gauntlet. It wasn't a fear of knifing or being beaten. But your hat would be taken away and thrown in a tree, or your books would be scattered, and that sort of thing. You weren't robbed, it wasn't being robbed. And if you put up a fuss, you might be pummeled a bit, and nobody liked that. But there wasn't the kind of danger of beatings or knifing.
Like there are now. Not racial, but maybe ethnic?
A lot of it was ethnic, so that there were neighborhoods which were Italian, streets right. were Italian, and you know, everybody who wasn't Italian went through that street. It wasn't just ethnic, because there was empty lot, I remember, and where they later built a school that I went to. But I remember that there used to be warfare on that lot. I mean, it was really scheduled rock fights where the children from another block, the boys from another block would challenge, and after school everybody would take garbage can lids and boxes and build forts and collect rocks, and then they would, at a certain point in time, they would start throwing rocks at one another.
Nothing now.
Oh, it was, but it, and nobody really got, I don't remember anybody really getting hurt severely, but these kids were mixed, I mean, it was street versus street, it wasn't ethnic versus ethnic. It was one block over, it was foreign territory. It was very interesting. And also going to school, especially when I lived on Shakespeare Avenue and went to another grade school, which was built on this empty lot, which was a middle school. And then I went to a junior high school. The middle school was within one block from my house, but the junior, or whatever it was, that I, junior high school was quite a ways away. And even in junior high school, you walked a certain path home and back. You didn't vary one street over to the right or the left, because it was dangerous. But it wasn't dangerous in the sense it's dangerous now. It was dangerous in the sense you might be pulled aside, your clothes taken from you, thrown in trees, your books scattered, any papers you had get pushed around. And if you fought back, then you get hit. But if you didn't fight back, you just took. You were alone. Now, there were groups of kids, so you tended to travel in convoys, because it was less likely that you would be assaulted. But that was compared to today, it was mild, very mild.
You said you skipped a number of grades. Was this at the lower level or in high school?
Not in high school. Once I got to high school, I didn't. But up through junior high, I skipped grades. So I graduated from high school when I was 15 and a half.
15 and a half. Now, before we get there, are there any, you say you can't remember too much, but was there anything in high school that influenced your later life? Did you become interested in science already at that
point? No, they almost killed my interest in everything in high school.
Okay.
It was the high schools I went to were not outstanding in their programs, and also although I was a good student, I was interested in other things, and I wasn't a very serious student in high school.
What were you interested in?
Girls.
That's good. You want to tell us a little bit?
No, it's a usual story.
Okay.
There's nothing unusual.
Was the high school also in the Bronx?
No. My family were very nomadic, and my mother wanted to get out of the city, and so we moved at a crucial time. Also, I didn't like the high school I was going to. I disliked it very much. Now, I disliked it because it was really poor. It was in the East Bronx. It was called the Vander Childs. I had to go there. And that school was very unpleasant. It was in the East Bronx, and there were lots of there was more racial tension, yeah, even in those days. Mostly Puerto Ricans were already moving into the East Bronx
at that school. Time. Mm-hmm. This was
in the
early 30s.
In the 30s.
Yeah.
And that school was I didn't like it at all, and I didn't like traveling there. It was a long commute for me.
How'd you go?
I think I went streetcar. Streetcars changing several times. So my mother decided we'd move into the suburbs and get out of the city. So we moved out to Queens, to Jackson Heights, which in those days was a bucolic place. Now it's all Colombian, some drug center of some Central American community. But it was a really bucolic place, and I just, I really liked it there. And I went to a high school called Newtown.
In Queens?
In Queens. And I went there till I graduated from high school. It was nice there because I had a bicycle and I had friends at the tennis courts, and I took up tennis, and there were lots of girls, and we'd walk to school, and there was lots of open space, and I liked it very much. Until I got into college, I graduated from high school, and I graduated, I was 15 and a half, and I got into New York University.
You went right from high school?
Yeah.
So you were very young.
I was 15 and a half. And I went into a program they had where you could start, since I graduated from high school for some reason, I graduated in mid-year. And NYU had a program that started in January, and you go through the summer and you could catch up your first year. So I actually did my first freshman year of high school, of college, in less than a year. And so then I had to commute by subway all the way up to university, because I didn't go to Washington Square. I went to University Heights campus, which was a very nice campus, and I enjoyed my years there. But I had to go by subway into Midtown Manhattan, mm-hmm. and then transfer up and that was really a hard commute for me. It was really crowded, everything was crowded, and I spent a lot of time on the subway.
How long?
It took me at least an hour to get to. Because then when I got up to University Heights, to the station, I had to take a trolley to get to school. So it was a complicated commute.
How was that financed, your college?
I think my mother, I wanted to go, and my family wanted me to go to Brown, but they couldn't afford it. When they looked at the prices, I didn't even apply because they couldn't pay them.
Do you remember what the tuition was in this
day? I can't remember, but it wasn't very high. So the tuition was, I don't know, they just scrimped and saved. By this time, sometime when I was, coincident with my going to NYU, I can't remember the exact year, but I think it was in my freshman year, after my freshman year, that my mother remarried. And so money wasn't a problem anymore. And also, with the marriage, we moved into Manhattan again, into Manhattan this time, onto West End Avenue, and 86th Street, 545 West End Avenue. And we lived there for the rest of my mother's life.
But you still went to the same campus throughout your undergraduate?
Yeah. I finished up at NYU.
But at the campus?
At the University of Heights campus. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At that point, were you interested in science yet? Do you remember?
I guess I was. I mean, I was an English major with a minor in biology and biology. And so I had ideas of being a writer and doing other things. Slowly, as I went through college, I had to think of what I was going to do, because it was clear that I was going to go to do some graduate work, something. My mother always wanted me to be a brain surgeon. She was very disappointed that I went for a PhD rather than for an MD degree. And was a good Jewish mother and saw her son as a surgeon of some kind. And I think that somebody, when I did this interview for the alumni, Medical Alumni News, he asked me that question, and I told him, I, you could turn off the tape recorder. I'd like to think about it a while, and I thought about it. And what happened was that we had a family doctor named Harry Solomon, who was a doctor ever since I could remember, since I was a child. And he had a nephew who specialized in infectious diseases. I wish I could remember his name. It wasn't Solomon, but practiced with him, but was an expert in infectious diseases. And when I was in the office one time, sort of thinking about where I was going to go, this man told me, he was a young physician, told me that he had gotten a master's degree from Michigan in microbiology, then it was called bacteriology. And I realized that that was something that interested me. And why? Because when I was a kid, I had every infectious disease you can think of. I mean, I was sick a lot of the time. And I had some serious illnesses, all infectious diseases, and came close to dying. One of the memories of my childhood is getting ready to die. I mean, I was that soon. And I think that that immediately appealed to me. I mean, I can't think of any other reason why I went into this field. I mean, when you think about why do you go into what you do, if you have a family that has a tradition, that's one reason people do things. My family had no tradition. I was the first person that ever graduated from college, all my cousins and everybody else. I was the first one. So there was no tradition. I think that may have had a big effect on my choice of field.
So you met this young man during your time at NYU?
Yes, yes.
And you did go to Michigan?
Yes, and I took his advice and applied to Michigan. Yeah.
What was it like going from New York to the wilds of Michigan in
1939?
Right.
Well, I can tell you, my family prepared me for this trip like I was going to Alaska.
I'm sure.
I had high boots and woolen underwear and fur-lined leather jackets and leather hats leather hats with fur lining with ear flaps. And I went with a footlocker full of clothes like that because they thought I was going to the ends of the earth. I mean, their idea of Michigan was like North Pole.
Sure.
So most of that stuff I never used because the winter's in Ann Arbor. I'm a little bit colder than New York. Maybe a little more snow. There are more ice storms for sure. But it's no different.
Now, how was that funded, your graduate program?
My stepfather was, by this time, he was making lots of money. He was quite well off.
And you got a master's degree in?
In microbiology and I got a public health minor because I didn't know what I wanted to do.
I see. Of your courses were in the School of Public Health?
Yes, I took courses there, but my enrollment was in the medical school because there was no university department in microbiology.
I see. So you graduate, you got an MS from the...
Because the medical school taught all the microbiology in the university.
And where did you live in Ann Arbor? Remember?
I lived on Church Street. The house isn't there anymore. I went back and looked for it. It's gone. But I took the 20th Century Limited in New York all by myself. It was the first time I'd ever traveled away from home by myself.
But we're leaving right now, so you don't have to worry.
Let me turn off for one second. Okay. Dr. Youngner, the disease that almost killed you, do you remember what it was?
It was lobar pneumonia.
Ooh.
I had bilateral lobar pneumonia. I remember playing out in the snow and coming home and getting chilled and going to bed and I remember I was 7 years old at the time. And I developed this lumbar pneumonia, a bilateral lumbar pneumonia. Both lungs were affected. And in those days, there was no antibiotics. And I'll just describe the illness because I have another dramatic story to tell you about lumbar pneumonia. And what I remember is that I was really ill. And we lived in an apartment and opened the windows. And I remember being in a bed next to the windows in the middle of winter just to get air. And then I remember having an oxygen tank in the house. They didn't keep me in the hospital.
Why?
Well, because in those days with lumbar pneumonia, there was something called a crisis. And you went through the crisis, and at that point you either lived or died. And that's because antibodies built up, and it was a question of whether the toxin would kill you before the antibodies were high enough concentration.
And they had why the open window?
They did so I could breathe, because my lungs were full of fluid from the infection. So your lungs consolidate, your lungs just exudate in your air passages, and you can't breathe. That's what pneumonia is. And I couldn't, and obviously I remember coming to the point where I called my mother to my bedside, and I said to her, I'm going to die now.
And you were 7 years old?
Yeah. And I said, I'm going to die now. So I'll say goodbye. I'm going to die. And that was the crisis. And within a couple of hours, I was well. My fever went down. Everything started to resolve, and I lived. But unfortunately, I developed complications. And I developed what's called empyema, which is probably a staphylococcal infection in the pleura inside the lung cavity. And it was so bad that it went through the pleural cavity and infected a rib. So now they had to take me to the hospital and to drain my chest cavity and take out that diseased piece of rib. Because the rib was, it was like osteomyelitis of the rib. So I went to the hospital. I also had, I believe, what must have been a meningitis after some kind of meningeal symptoms, maybe some heart defect. Because when they went to the hospital, this was, when we went to Flower Fifth Avenue Hospital, which was a Catholic hospital, for some reason, it may have been that Harry Solomon was practicing there at the time before he went to Bellevue. Because later on in life he was a big muck-a-muck in Bellevue. But this had to be a surgical procedure, and so in those days anesthesia was also very limited, and they were afraid to use ether because of my respiratory, I just had recovered from pneumonia, so they couldn't use ether. And what they did was to operate on me without anesthetic. And I remember they strapped my legs to an operating table, and two nuns held my arms above my head and prayed while they operated on me. To this day, I can remember the feeling of the saucer on my rib.
Of the what?
Saw.
Saw, S-A-W, saw.
And I have they took out a piece of rib, so I have it's called a thoracotomy, where they take out a piece of rib. And I remember this operation for my whole life, so that later in life, when I had to have some minor surgery, I put it off for years. Because I was so so affected by this this episode. And it wasn't until I actually had to go to surgery that I started to talk about it, because I hadn't talked about it with anybody. And so I talked about it with my wife and told her why I wasn't going, why I had been putting off this minor, very minor surgery. Then explained it to the physician, the surgeon, and the anesthesiologist. He had the anesthesiologist talk to me. And so before my minor surgery, I don't know how many Valiums they gave me. But I still had a real fear, real phobia about surgery. Mm-hmm. Now the story is over, but then this empyema, this didn't go away just like that, this staph infection in my chest cavity. And so they stuck a drain in with a bottle at the end and sent me home with that. And I missed, I don't know how much school, maybe a term of school, where I was drained, my chest was draining into that bottle all the time. I had that in all the time. It's the bottle that hung down from my, this thing was in my. And then I remember I had to go back to the hospital because it healed in, and they couldn't even clean the drain because it was something had healed around it, and so they had to cut it out, and oh, this mess. And I remember being taken on a chair by a black man. I don't know.